Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight, we're bringing you part one of a special program in conjunction with the Spokesman Review. Now in its sixth year, the newspaper's Summer Stories Project publishes a series of short fiction pieces written by local authors, all centered around a particular theme. This year's theme is Summer of 69, marking the 50th anniversary of that momentous summer. Tonight, we'll hear this year's first two summer stories, beginning with Sean Vestal, reading his story, New Mom.
New Mom. Lunch was bologna, Wonder Bread, and Red Fanta in glass bottles bought at Safeway in Sandpoint and eaten in the car as they rode north with the windows rolled down. When the bottles were empty, their father would lob them, left-handed, at the roadsides along the freeway. Bonner's Ferry, 11 miles. Highway 95 Junction. U.S. Border, 7 miles. A couple hits, a couple of misses. The air was hot, slapping through the windows. The children were shouting questions about Beverly to their father. "Does she look like Mom?" "Not exactly," he said. "Maybe a little bit." "Is that why you like her?" "No, I wouldn't say that." "Is she prettier?" "Let's not talk about your mother right now." "Can we have whatever we want at the restaurant?" Their father had been trying to teach them restaurant manners at home in preparation for the rehearsal dinner before the wedding, but he wasn't sure he knew what restaurant manners were himself. Beverly's parents were paying for everything, and Beverly's parents were old and wealthy and Mormon, Salt Lake City Mormon, though they had immigrated to Canada. Beverly had warned him that they were not bothering to hide their disappointment that their lovely youngest daughter, their pride and joy, was marrying a divorced Jack Mormon with three kids from nowhere, Idaho. Her parents, the father had no doubt, knew the right manners for every restaurant. The kids had taken to calling Beverly New Mom when their father wasn't around. "Do you think New Mom will be nice? How did Dad meet New Mom?" "She's a lot younger than Mom," meaning old mom, first mom, "so I bet she's pretty nice." They didn't know the answers to any of the questions. Their father just kept telling them they'd meet her soon enough and then they'd know anything they needed to know. The children didn't want to wait. They wanted to know now. "Might as well get used to it," their father said. "Everybody's got to wait for everything." On the radio, between the songs, the announcer was talking about a river that had caught fire in Ohio. "A river on fire," their father said, more to himself than them. "Signs and wonders." At the Canadian border, a man in a green uniform asked their father questions about why they were going to Canada, and their father answered them happily. "Going to pick up his new wife in Cranbrook," he said. "She's a Canadian citizen, moving with him back to Lewiston. He works at the paper plant there." "Yes, they're all his. Their mother is out of the picture." The children thought about that, out of the picture. Somewhere, but not in the frame. Somewhere, but not visible. Old Mom, their father always said, had a lot of problems, and none of them were the children's fault. Before she went away, she would sometimes spend days on end in her bed with the shades drawn and the door shut, and then sometimes she would be gone all night or gone for days at a time, and if they asked their dad where she was, he would only say she'd be back soon. She was having problems, he would say, but none of them were the children's fault. And he kept saying that after the time that she never came back at all. Their father emphasized this so much that they were not to blame for old mom's disappearance, that the children felt sure they actually were to blame. How long would they be in Canada, the man in the green uniform wanted to know. 3 days, their father said. In and out. Quick as can be. The father could not understand choosing to live in Canada, choosing to leave America and live there. He worried about Beverly's parents and about Beverly herself over this choice. He worried there might be things about her, about them, that he couldn't see clearly yet, and when those things became apparent, they would have the power to ruin his life. At the motel, they all stayed in one room. The father and Blake shared one queen bed. Anna and Kendra shared the other. Little Stockholm slept in the fold-up cot. In the morning, the father woke them and hustled them around, getting them ready to meet Beverly at her family's house. There was a luncheon first, not like the dinner they'd have that night at the restaurant, but still, a good manners thing. The father worried that the kids would misbehave, embarrass him in front of Beverly's parents. He thought the room smelled like the inside of a huge, dirty sock, and he worried that Beverly would someday know this smell and recoil, regret her decision. Stockholm and Kendra jumped back and forth between the beds until he shouted at them so loudly that everyone froze in place. He didn't hit them very much, but that was what he sounded like when he did. "Come on now," the father said, heart galloping in his ears. "Please." New Mom's house looked like a castle. It had spires and cupolas and a large porch. It was painted a deep red and had a foundation of gray stone. New Mom's dad was a lumber baron, their father had told them. "What's a lumber baron?" Kendra had asked. "Somebody whose dad got rich underpaying guys to cut down trees," their father said. "Somebody who got rich being born." When Beverly came onto the porch in a bright, fancy, flowery dress, the children thought they'd never seen anyone so lovely. No one back home wore bright, fancy, flowery dresses like that, like something in a movie. New Mom held up a hand to shade the sun as they approached the house. She wore shiny shoes of a pale blue shade the children felt they had never seen before, a whole new color. When they reached the massive stone porch, New Mom crouched down in her dress to look each of them in the eye, to take them by the shoulders and say hello, to tell them in a sweet voice that she looked forward to making a nice, new, happy family together. Then she embraced each of them in descending order, strange, careful hugs in which the children could smell her sharp perfume and hear the starched rustle of her dress as it pressed lightly against them. At the restaurant, there was a long table in a back room, draped in white cloth, and the kids sat at the very end of the table, Blake and Stockholm on one side, Anna and Kendra on the other. Their father and Beverly sat in the middle of the long table on one side, across from Beverly's parents on the other. Various other people filled in the rest. Their father told Anna she was in charge of making sure everyone behaved. He told them what to order. "I don't want to have to come down here," he said. Stockholm climbed down from his chair and crouched under the table. It was dark and cool under there. Everyone's feet were down there. Stockholm slapped at his sister's shoes. They were shiny black with straps and buckles. Anna's head came down under the tablecloth. "Get back in your seat," she whispered. Stockholm liked it down there. It was strange and dim and unfamiliar. "Stockholm," she hissed. It was like being underwater, he thought. All the interesting legs and shoes, all the darkness and safety. He started crawling toward the feet of his father. He saw his father's shoes down there, the brown leather shoes with the patterns of dots, newly polished. "Young man," Anna whispered, "I'm not going to tell you again." Stockholm crawled over the feet between him and his father, the pumps and the wingtips and the Oxfords. A minor commotion above the table followed his motion below. When he reached the large, wide, shining black shoes of Beverly's father, the lumber baron, the minor commotion turned major. Beverly's father shouted in surprise and lumbered to his feet, blustering. Their father's face blanched, and he was failing to keep a smile on his face while he spat out the names of his children, condemning them and imploring them and chastising them all at once. Anna, Stockholm, Blake, Kendra. It was like he had lost the use of all other words. Beverly materialized beside them, holding Stockholm by the hand. "Let's go have a cup of ice cream," she said. In her fancy voice, in her fancy dress, she swept them from the room where their father was sitting with his alabaster face, and the other guests were laughing or clucking about what had happened there in the candlelight, where the lumber baron was frowning, no longer exclaiming with an unreadable combination of consternation and amusement that he had thought a raccoon was eating his shoelaces. She swept them into another room in the restaurant, a side room of sorts where one man stood behind a bar and one man sat at the bar, and the television was playing. "You don't mind, do you, Ralph, if we take refuge back here in the corner for just a moment?" Beverly said. And the man behind the bar said in a friendly, joking way, "I suppose not, Bev. but no drinks for the miners. On the television, the river in Ohio was still burning. She got them scoops of ice cream in little silver cups and said, "Dessert before dinner is the best," with a conspiratorial smile. Kendra giggled. Stockham nodded in sober agreement. They looked at the TV while they ate their ice cream, at the fire on the water, and Beverly said, "My word." Anna wanted to ask if they were going back to dinner, and she said, "Ma'am?" And Beverly said, "Oh, no, no, no. Please call me Beverly, or anything else. You could call me, well, you could call me whatever you like, any old thing." And Blake said, "New mom?" And something passed across Beverly's face, a kink in her manner that made each of them realize it had been a wrong step. They never said those words again in her presence. But among themselves, in the days to come, they continued to call her new mom, even as they returned to Lewiston and lived in their white bungalow with a view of the Snake River, where it divides the states, a view into Clarkston from their front step, as they grew to like her even more, and then, soon, to love her. Somehow, for some reason, Blake started calling her Noom, just among the other kids, Noom, Noom. He was nicknaming everybody aggressively then, in his high school years, and Noom had the sound and simplicity of a name, of a sound inseparable from a person. Later still, after the children were older, away on their own, they told Beverly that this had been their name for her, their secret name, and she told them she loved it. She asked them to call her that, to call her Noom, because it was just between them, a piece of code. It became her name. Eventually, even their father called her Noom. They stayed married the rest of their lives. The family stayed together, happy sometimes and not sometimes, but mostly fine, healthy and lucky and safe. And she was with them when their father died, to help them through, to comfort them, to tell them that it felt sad and hard and unfair, because it was sad and hard and unfair. No point in wishing it otherwise. They all felt wiser for having her in their lives, and they were close, all of them, a family still, for years after, Noom and the children, and then the grandchildren, who also called her Noom, all as close as if they sprang from the same blood, and the children were with her all the way to her end, too, all four of them at her bedside when she took her final gasping breath.
That was Sean Vestal reading his short story, New Mom. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Tonight, we're listening to short fiction written by local authors and published in the Spokesman Review's Summer Stories series. This year's theme is Summer of 69, and each author interpreted that theme in their own unique way. Next, we'll hear Chris Dennison reading her story, The Island.
The Island. Charlie got on his knees, leaning out the car window. He was looking for landmarks. They were close to the cabin, he knew that, but until he saw the no trespassing sign and then caught a glimpse of the island, he couldn't be sure. "Charlie, sit down, dear. That's not safe." "Mom," he whined, but he sat. "You going to swim to the island this year, Chuck?" His brother Walt swam to the island and back every year. Charlie usually canoed alongside him, but he'd never tried the swim himself. "I might." Charlie picked at a loose thread on his cutoffs. He wanted to swim with Walt, but if he tried and didn't make it, he thought that would be worse than not trying at all. "Sure he will," Charlie's dad chimed in. "Cliff, don't badger the boy." Charlie knew his mom was trying to help, but her protection made it worse. "I'm not badgering anyone, Sheila." His dad slowed the car and turned the left blinker on. "Walt made the swim when he was, what, 12? "I don't remember," Walt said, but Charlie knew he was lying. "I'll get the gate, Dad." "I'll help," Charlie said. The boys jumped from the car and together they swang the metal gate wide. After the car and trailer passed through, they pushed it shut and followed the car down the drive. "You don't have to do the swim, you know," Walt said. Charlie felt a tangle of fear and uncertainty tighten in his gut as he thought of the island, pictured the expanse of opaque water that stretched between it and the cabin. "I know," Charlie shoved his hands in his pockets, "but I might." Walt looked at him sideways. "Race ya." Walt took off down the curve of dirt and gravel that led to the cabin, Charlie right behind him. At the last moment, Walt stumbled and Charlie slapped his hand on the forest green siding. Charlie knew Walt had probably let him win. He usually did, but he relished the victory all the same. That night, after they unpacked and settled in, they sat around the campfire full of marshmallows and heavy with the fatigue particular to being outside all day. Charlie found himself nodding off, but didn't want to leave the warm circle of light and family. He lay down on the bench with his head on a wadded-up sweatshirt. As he watched the fire, he dozed, moving in and out of consciousness in a delicious sort of way. After a while, he became aware of the snippets of whispered conversation between Walt and his dad. "Don't go," his father was saying. "I mean it. The things I saw in Germany, the things they'd done to those people." Charlie was fully awake now. His dad never talked about the war, never wanted to see the old war movies Charlie sometimes watched on Saturday afternoons. And when Charlie would ask what it was like, his dad only ever said, "I hope you never know." "I don't want to go, Dad, but what am I supposed to do?" Gone was the confidence in Walt's voice, the cheer. He sounded desperate, unsure. "You could go to school. Get a deferment." Charlie's mom's voice broke on the word deferment like it was this precious thing she could hardly bear to speak of. "Mom, don't." Charlie watched his brother put a comforting arm around their mother, which made her shoulders shake and her face shiny with tears in the firelight. Walt saw then that Charlie was awake. "We can talk about this later." Walt squeezed their mom and kissed her wet cheek. "Besides, it's our first night in the cabin, which means we have a tradition to uphold, right, brother?" Charlie grinned at him. Their mom stood. "Oh, no," but she was smiling a little now. "Haven't you outgrown that yet? What will the neighbors think?" Charlie and Walt both jumped up, running from the fire pit to the dock. Once there, they shed their clothes, the waxing crescent moon barely illuminating their pale skin. Walt threw himself off the end of the dock. Charlie followed. They both whooped and laughed at the wild pleasure of the bracing water on their naked bodies and the darkness all around as they bobbed and floated in a world of their own making. "Don't worry about any of that stuff Mom and Dad were saying, okay, Chuck?" Walt said from the stern of the canoe the next day. Charlie paddled a few more strokes, his eyes on the entrance to the creek that fed into the lake at its western end. "What will you do, though?" he asked Walt after a minute. Walt didn't answer right away. "I got my letter. I guess I'll go." Charlie thought about this as the canoe sliced through the gentle chop of the lake. "Joe Nelson's brother Chip, he didn't come back." Walt was silent, the only sound their paddles and the lap of the waves against the canoe. "Joe and his mom went to one of those protests at the courthouse after Chip died. He's pretty mad about it." Walt steered them into the creek. The high grassy banks narrowed and rose up, hiding the lake and the fields from view. "I would be too." "There's got to be a reason, though, right?" Charlie asked. A group of ducks, startled by the canoe, took off flapping and quacking. "Charlie, if I figure it out, I promise I'll let you know." That night after dinner, Walt and their dad smoked on the porch while Charlie helped his mom with the dishes. He heard them talking through the open window. "I've been thinking about it, son. Where to go?" "Dad, listen. No son of mine is going to throw himself away, brutal, senseless. I might not even see combat. Go to Canada. Stay with your sister until this madness is over. Lots of guys make it through. She'll take you in. If I go, I can't come back." Charlie heard the crackle of his dad lighting another cigarette, the heavy exhale and acrid smell of that first drag. "Canada," he said. Charlie waited for Walt to argue. "Promise me, son." If Walt made that promise, Charlie didn't hear it. Charlie couldn't sleep that night. If Walt went to Canada, he'd be alive, but gone. He guessed that would be better than what happened to Chip. But what could Charlie say to someone like Joe, whose brother had gone and didn't come back? He could hear Walt tossing and sighing in the top bunk. "Walt," Charlie whispered. "Yeah?" "How long do you think it would take me to swim to the island?" "There and back?" Walt asked. "Yeah." "I don't know, an hour maybe?" "Okay." "Okay what?" "Okay, I'll do it, tomorrow, just in case." Walt was quiet a long time and Charlie wondered if he'd gone to sleep. "Walt?" "Yeah, okay, just in case." Charlie felt exhausted by his decision. He closed his eyes, and sleep came like a door closing. The next day, it rained, and the day after that. Several times, Charlie walked into a room and knew he'd interrupted a discussion he wasn't meant to hear, his parents and Walt acting as if that wasn't the case. In between these aborted conversations, Charlie and Walt did puzzles, read comic books, played way too many games of hangman and Yahtzee. When they got bored with more conventional distractions, they pretended the floor was hot lava and moved around the cabin, jumping from couch to end table to bookshelf, until Walt broke a picture frame and their mom ordered them to stop. By the third day of rain, they thought they'd come out of their skins, but after breakfast, the sun broke through, sending a rainbow arcing over the lake and the island. Finally, Walt pushed through the screen door and ran, whooping through the woods. Charlie followed, his pants and sneakers soaked by the saturated grass and underbrush of the forest floor. Walt led him across the road and onto a deer trail that wound up the steep hill to the north of the lake. By the time they reached the top, they were soaked and sweating, and the sky held more blue than gray. Walt threw himself down on a patch of grass in the sun. Charlie perched on a log beside him. "I thought that rain would never stop," Walt sat up and took off his t-shirt, wiping his face with it. "I bet it rains a lot," Charlie said. "In the jungle?" "A fair amount." "In school, we read about how in World War I, the soldiers' feet went rotten because of the rain and the trenches. I wonder if that happens over there."
"It might."
"I mean, what do you do if your foot gets rotten?"
"Can we talk about something else?" Walt asked.
"Do they drain it or something? Can you walk?"
"On second thought," Walt said, "let's just sit and enjoy the view."
Charlie shifted on the log, then looked out over the water, the island, the cedar and tamarack-covered hills on the darker, roadless south side of the lake. From up here, the water seemed calm and blue, but Charlie knew up close it would still be a little murky, stirred up from the storm. He stared hard at the island, tracing the path between their dock, which was barely visible at this height, to the near side of the island and back. He wasn't sad the rain had delayed the swim. They heard the ringing of the triangle their mom used to call them in for meals. "Race ya!" Walt took off down the pass, still shirtless. Charlie ran after him, stumbling and flailing down the hill. As they came out of the woods, Charlie lagged behind by a couple yards. But this time, Walt didn't pretend to stumble, didn't slow his pace. Charlie almost caught him anyway, but Walt's hand slapped the cabin wall just a moment ahead of Charlie's. "You almost beat me fair and square," Walt panted from the effort. "You're not a kid anymore." Charlie felt his chest open, expand. Walt punched him lightly on the shoulder. "Let's eat. I'm starved." That night at dinner, Charlie noticed his mom's eyes were red and moist, and a little muscle bulged and flexed in his dad's jaw as he chewed. They discussed what they would do with the 2 days they had left. Some fishing and a picnic, maybe an early morning canoe to watch the moose feeding in the creek. "Should we do it tomorrow?" Walt asked. Charlie knew he meant the island. He took a bite of mac and cheese, swallowed, then nodded. "Tomorrow." The room shone bright with sunlight when Charlie woke the next day. He shuffled into the kitchen, poured himself some cornflakes, and chewed sleepily. He could see his mom sitting on the porch, so he carried his bowl out to join her. She'd been crying again. "Where's Dad and Walt?" His mom held a tissue to her nose for a moment before answering. "Your dad went for a drive. She took a deep breath. "Your brother's gone." Without speaking, Charlie stood and walked to the dock. Lifting his eyes, he saw the path of glittering sunlight and dark green water leading from where he stood to the island. He moved to the edge, took a deep breath, and dove in.
That was author Chris Dinnison reading her short story, The Island. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode, we featured the first two stories in the Spokesman Review's Summer Stories Project. You can find the full text of these stories online at spokesman.com. And you can also listen back to this and many other Bookshelf episodes by subscribing to the Bookshelf podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or the NPR One app. Tune in tomorrow to hear two more short stories by authors Stephanie Oakes and Megan Rowe. For the Bookshelf, I'm Chris Messini.